This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Last week in the wooded area behind the VPR studios in Colchester, a red-shouldered hawk swooped in and perched in a tree for a while. We were mesmerized. There it sat amid a forest of the most beautiful fall leaves, and all we could see was this majestic, powerful bird. Oh, man, birds. There are 200 to 400 million of them in this world, and spotting just one can make your day. Right now, a good lot of them are taking part in the annual fall migration, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Finches, snow geese, Canada geese, eagles, and whatever's on your mind regarding migrating birds. Call us at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also email your thoughts or questions to vermontedition@vpr.net. Here to tell us now about the fall bird migration, some of the challenges birds are facing, and to take your calls about birds is the bird diva, Bridget Butler. Bridget, welcome back.
Hey, hi, Rick. It's so great to be here again.
A red-shouldered hawk.
You know, I love your intro stories. They're always so good. And I like sit on the edge of my seat waiting for what, you know, what is the new sighting from this area? That red-shouldered hawk, actually, you guys have a birding hotspot, like basically right across the street here, Woodside Natural Area.
Oh, yeah.
And that bird, maybe even that same individual bird, is seen there an awful lot. There's some beautiful trails down there. It's one of the spots that I like to drop into after the bird show.
It was a big, burly fella. I mean,
yeah.
It was healthy. It has eaten well, it looked
like.
Yeah,
good.
Incredible. What have people been reporting that they've seen migrating so far this year?
Yeah, so, you know, there's all kinds of great stuff that's been happening this year, especially with the lower water levels on Lake Champlain.
Right.
So we're seeing record lows, which means that there's more mud flats. So where here in Vermont, we don't normally get really super excited about shorebirds because we just don't have the right type of habitat for that. This was that kind of year. And so birders were going a little bit crazy trying to find the hot spots where there would be some of these birds.
What kind of shorebirds?
So we're talking about greater yellow legs, lesser yellow legs, killdeer, dunlin, all kinds of different sandpipers, just a huge array of these little long-legged shorebirds that are either going to wade in the water or kind of run back and forth in the mudflats. And I had a good time with this. I'm not really super confident with my shorebird ID, but I had a lot of fun trying to go and look and learn how to look at those birds, which is completely different than how you would look at a warbler. So I really enjoyed what the drought brought this year in terms of migrating birds. The other one that just popped up in my yard this week and made me think of when you were talking about the red-shouldered hawk was one that we didn't have on our family backyard bird list. And so my family, we keep a backyard bird list each year. We've got these giant like post-it notes up on the walls, and we just keep track of everything that we hear or see. You have to be standing in the yard in order to count the bird.
Mm-hmm.
And so after about 2 months of not having any new birds in the yard, we had purple finches.
Oh, my.
At the bird feeder. And I was so excited because that's a tough one to identify. There's another bird that has that cranberry red color to it called a house finch. Purple finches are a little bit bigger, a little bit more robust. And when you look at their face, they have some different streaks or stripes on the face that can kind of help you tell the difference between house finch and purple finch. But they're one that normally they do breed here in Vermont, but they are found in greater numbers up north. So this is one of those winter finches that's going to push down into this region as we get into the wintertime. And so I was excited to see both a male and a female at our feeder.
Well, let's talk about the finches. There's the Winter Finch Report. So first of all, what is that about and what are they reporting?
Yeah. So the Winter Finch Report comes out each year from an ornithologist from Ontario. His name's Ron Pittaway. And basically what he does is he gathers a whole bunch of information about cone crops and seed crops. And so the winter finches are this group of birds that breed north of here, tend to breed up in the boreal forest regions, and rely on these cone crops. So birches, hemlock, spruce, mountain ash. So he's looking at berries as well, fruiting trees. And when the cone crops or the fruit crops are bad up north, these birds push out and look for food elsewhere. So these guys are more of a shorter distance migrant than a long distance migrant, like a bird like a bobolink who's going to leave the grasslands here and go to South America. So these guys are going to push from up in Canada down into our region if the cone crops are bad.
So what does he tell us this year?
Yeah, so this year, and this is what's great. He says purple finches will leave northern breeding areas and come down this way. Because they are looking for seed crops from conifers, and they're just not plentiful up north. So these guys are going to show up at our feeders. So it's a good time to start to bust out your feeders again to be able to help some of these birds. Some of the other ones that you can find at your feeder are common redpoll and pine siskin. These are smaller birds. Like if you think of like a chickadee and then make it a little bit skinnier, the coloration is really different. These are most finches are streaky in coloration and might have just a bit of a hint of color. Pine siskins have a hint of yellow. And red polls, oh my gosh, they're so cute. They have this great little red cap on them and then a black chin patch. Mm-hmm. So they will stand out at your feeder. So red polls and pine siskins, it's kind of like a maybe thing. We don't really know if they're going to show up or not. It's a possibility. And then crossbills, which is another really unique bird, strange in the way that its bill has evolved to be able to you're doing it with your fingers.
Yeah, it kind of crosses over.
Yeah, it crosses over. And what it does is it's able to wedge that beak in between the scales of a pine cone. And as it opens its beak, it's able to kind of peel the scale back and then get its tongue in there to flick out the pine seed. Really amazing bird. So we have a chance of seeing these guys as well. I think the best spot, if you want to go after crossbills this year, is take a trip up to the Northeast Kingdom. There are some wonderful hotspots for birding up there, including Moose Bog. The Silvio Conti Wildlife Refuge is a really nice spot there.
And Lewis,
Lewis. Lewis Pond and South America Pond Road. Like, how can you forget that name? So you're going to go to South America up in the Northeast Kingdom to get some really good bird species up there.
I don't even know where that is.
Oh, my gosh. It's so...
That's fantastic.
It's worth the drive. Bundle up. Pack a nice hot thermos of coffee or whatever you like to warm your heart on a cold day and watch for those crossbills up there.
And if people spot any of these finches, do they report them anywhere?
Yeah, you know, and this is something that I really like to talk about a lot is, you know, we have this passion for birds. We love to watch them at our feeder. A lot of us write them down like my family does with our bird list. But the next thing that you can do with that, that's actually data that's really valuable. So you can add that to something called eBird, which is an online platform where you can keep track of the birds that you see, but then your data is going to help scientists. And in fact, many of the reports that come out about the status of birds and how they're doing, whether it's from the National Audubon Society or the American Bird Association, they take our data and they use it to look at different types of trends.
Wow.
So just what we're seeing in our backyard, like that purple finch, by reporting that to eBird, scientists can get a good idea of what migration patterns are like throughout the year.
It's our annual fall bird migration show. Have you spotted something out of the ordinary this year? Or do you need help identifying a bird you've recently seen? You can call 1-800-639-2211. 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We heard from Catherine. She posted on our Facebook page, living by the Tom Hanek Reservoir in Hoosick Falls, New York. I've wondered if the cormorants and egrets truly migrate.
So, yeah, they're going to move out as the weather gets colder. So a lot of times what I like to tell people to think about is think about the resources that are available to a bird to be able to survive. And what do they need in order to do that? And it's food, good habitat, good shelter, and nesting areas. And so some birds are gonna leave in order to find those things that they need. And as the temperature drops and the water freezes over, especially cormorants are a fish-eating bird, herons also, they're going to push out. Now, she said Hoosick Falls, though, right? So that implies to me that there's running water somewhere. Wow. So sometimes you have these pockets of places where the water is going to stay open. It's going to stay open for longer, especially as we see warmer winters happening. So we're going to start to see some trends where birds are going to stick around longer, where normally we would have seen them leave earlier. And again, that's where our reports can come into play a lot as we look at how climate change is impacting birds as well.
And not all birds migrate. What birds stick around our area?
Yeah, so I migration, we can break it up into a couple of different categories. We have the resident birds that are going to stick around, right? So if you think cardinal, chickadee, juncos, and juncos are fascinating because they are short distance migrants. They're our next kind of category. So if we go from resident to short distance migrant, even though juncos are around year round, they actually move from the higher elevations to the lower elevations. So many people are starting to see those down in the lowlands now. I'm seeing them in my backyard around feeders. Then you've got mid distance migrants, which are probably going to stay within the continental United States. And then our long distance migrants that are going to, make that hop out over the ocean or shoot off of Florida and head down to some of those islands or all the way down to Argentina to spend their winter.
Then you've got the Arctic tern that just goes like 50,000 miles a year.
Yeah, completely blows minds. The other one that I love to think about is the black pole warbler, which is a high elevation species bird. But this bird goes out over the Atlantic Ocean for some reason on its fall migration and then cuts back to the islands of Hispaniola.
Absolutely incredible. Gail's calling us from North Stratford in New Hampshire. Gail, thanks so much for calling Vermont Edition.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I really love this because I love to keep track of the different birds I see. I camp in Island Pond, Vermont, which is almost due west of North Stratford. And lo and behold, we heard a strange bird sound that sounded like a whiny kind of call. My son went down the beach to look, and he found the yellow-bellied sapsucker. And we found all of the concentric holes. It digs for, it kind of drills into the trunk of the tree.
Wonderful.
And I've never seen a yellow-bellied sapsucker either here at home or in Vermont.
Now, is that normal, Bridget, for a yellow-bellied sapsucker to be in Island Pond?
Yeah, sure. And this is in the woodpecker family.
Uh-huh.
They look a lot like a hairy or downy woodpecker, but you kind of want to look on the wing for this nice, we would say vertical wing bar, wing patch. And it will have that red patch if it's a male or a white on the head if it's a female, but has a behavior a lot like hairy and downy woodpeckers. Sapsuckers like trees that are going to ooze sap, so they're going to be, hitting our birches and sometimes maples. Oddly enough, even some of the conifers as well, in order to either drink the sap or create a well where insects will come to that well to feed on what's oozing out of the tree, and then the sapsucker will eat that insect.
What brilliant birds.
Yeah, so smart.
Oh, I love that. Sue and Brandon wrote to us. She says, on October 7th, several birders arrived at the Pomainville Wildlife Management Area in Pittsford in search of the uncommon Nelson's sparrow. Find it we did. Not just one, but five of them. I believe it is the second highest number found in Vermont. So what can you tell us about Nelson's sparrows?
That I have yet to see one, so
wow.
I am very envious of you. Good on you. I saw that report come across eBird and then also the Vermont Bird Listserv, which is another great way to get in touch with folks. So this is another little bird that pops up during fall migrations, and birders are very keen at following weather patterns and the seasonality of migration. So when we have a nice cold front that pushes through, after that cold front, we're often going to get birds that are going to start to move. They're going to take advantage of the wind and the weather in order to kind of make a move and move south. So this sparrow is one that folks keep their eye out for, but you often don't see it with other sparrows. So that's what was so amazing about this bird, is that there were five of them all together.
Now, that happened on October 7th. Would they still be hanging in this area by now, or have they moved on?
Yeah, so there's a possibility that it might still be there. I'm not sure if people are still reporting it at this point in time. I have a feeling it's probably moved on, right? So if you get bad weather that comes back in for this bird, they're going to hunker down and try to find food in that area. If food is plentiful, they're going to bulk up. A lot of these birds, when they need to migrate, they've got to double their body weight. And each time you take a long flight, you're going to deplete that. And so fat is the key thing that you really, really need. It's like eating a lot of burgers as a person in order to put on enough body fat to handle that. So these birds are gonna rest up, eat as much as they can, and then move on when that weather is good again. I would love to know if this bird is still around. I don't know if I'm going to have the opportunity to chase it down. And the thing that I think about, too, when I see these reports come from other places in the state, is I think about what's the habitat that this bird is seeing or being seen in.
Right.
And where can I find this habitat where I live? And I think that's part of the fun about taking that deep dive into bird watching is you don't always have to chase the bird, but you have to know what the bird needs in that moment.
Now, another of these migrating superstars is something called the bar-tailed godwit, which goes 7,000 miles without stopping. 8 days it'll fly. So that one really has to bulk up before it makes its migration. And Dave posted, red-bellied nuthatches appeared in Mount Holly, first time sighting, and they're from the northern migration. So is that part of the Finch forecast?
That is part of the Finch forecast. So there's three birds that we can kind of look at that are not they're kind of resident birds, but they kind of push around. The red-breasted nuthatch is one of them. So Ron Pittaway's forecast calls for an early southward movement that began in the summertime, so in probably around August, and continued movement is expected through December. So poor cone crops in the northeast are going to push this bird down as well. I get white-breasted nuthatches in my yard. I will definitely be keeping my eye out for red-breasted. They're a little bit skinnier, more dark coloration across the cap, and an eye stripe as well. So, and then the nice rusty red to the breast on this bird.
Well, sounds beautiful. We're talking about the fall bird migration with bird diva Bridget Butler. Just ahead, we'll hear the details about the rescue of an injured bald eaglet. And we're still taking your calls at 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your questions or comments on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. Today's Vermont Edition is a politics-free zone. The whole hour is dedicated to apolitical birds, specifically those that are migrating to warmer climes. Bird diva Bridget Butler is with us to share her expertise. But before we go back to Bridget, we want to spend a few minutes talking to Craig Newman. He's the director of Outreach for Earth Stewardship in Shelburne. And Craig was recently involved with the rescue and rehabilitation of an injured young bald eagle. Craig, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Oh, great to be here, Rick.
All right, give us some details about the age of the young eagle, what happened to it, and how it was discovered injured.
Okay, well, he was hatched from a nest in Ferrisburg. I won't go into specific details on the location because it's important that we give these guys their privacy, but long story short is he was nearing the point where he was going to fledge, and he exited the nest prematurely. We don't really know the reasons. It might have been a predator, might have been another large bird, great horned owl, who knows, but anyway, the bird ended up on the ground, and the lucky thing was that he was the subject of some pretty intense scrutiny from people that really went out of their way to keep an eye out for this guy, and he was on private property, so the landowner and a couple other of concerned citizens said, not notice the bird up in the tree and in the nest, and started calling, but due to circumstances, the reports didn't get to the proper people, and the bird spent some time on the ground. So,
what was the nature of the injury, Craig?
The wing was injured due to the fall, I'm guessing. He also was missing, four primaries on his wing, which are the flight feathers. And when they're just emerging, as young birds are developing, they have a blood supply. And when they're bent or broken, they bleed. And during that time of year, which was, June, I think it was the 21st, it was pretty warm. And as a result, flies had laid their eggs, and the wounds became infested with maggots. So good news is he was still being cared for by the adults. So,
on rescuing it, did you have to worry about the adults attacking you?
That's always in the back of your mind. It's a possibility. So I know it was kind of heart-wrenching to carry that young bird off from the nest site and with mom or dad up on the nest and kind of giving that pathetic little cheeping sound that they're known to do, and knowing that you were taking away their offspring. So, but there were no incidents, and we got the bird back and immediately started to get that wound cleaned up. And
yeah, what did you do with it once you got it back to your facility there at Shelburne Farms?
Well, first thing is get on the phone to our vet, which is Richmond Animal Hospital, Dr. Dan Hammett in Richmond. And, of course, he was really anxious to see the bird, so we got him in, and we took a look at it and proceeded to start cleaning the maggots out, which is no easy task. And that procedure took pretty much first 5 or 6 days, daily anesthetizing the bird and cleaning and flushing the wound out. And of course, our goal was to hopefully save that wing and feather tracks so that new feathers would emerge and we'd have a good possibility of releasing. So,
and you were successful with that, correct?
It was. It was a group effort. We after we had the bird for about 5 weeks, and it was obvious he needs a lot of space to exercise those wings, and he went off to Vins down in Woodstock, and he was finished up his conditioning and rehab there, and last week we released him down at Dead Creek in Virgins.
And what was that like when it was released back into the wild?
It's always that's always the goal, is to see these creatures go back into the wild where they belong, and it's always a thrill. We aren't always successful with every bird that comes in. If we had a magic wand, then maybe that would be the case, but we don't. So, especially since Vermont, one of the last states to have breeding bald eagles, and their numbers are on the rise here, and it was great to add another eagle citizen to that population.
Did you name it?
We didn't.
Okay.
I know there were a few suggestions, but I don't believe he ended up with a name. He or she.
Greg Newman is the director of Outreach for Earth Stewardship. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
And listeners, you can join the conversation today about the fall bird migration. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Bridget, we just heard about this bald eagle. And when we see these raptors, these birds in the wild, I mean, we want to get a closer look, a clearer look. I think of the nesting peregrine falcons, for instance. But how should we behave around them? What's the proper etiquette?
Yeah, so, you know, I think of I think of owls and the excitement that we're going to have as some of the owls move into the area for the winter, whether it's snowy owls or long-eared or short-eared owls. I think of loons on the inner lakes and ponds during the summertime. And I think what we have to keep in mind is that our presence can stress birds out. Especially birds that we don't see at our feeder,
yeah.
Right? So these are birds, and these birds are trying to reproduce as well. So during the nesting season, it's always, always good to keep your distance, which means get a pair of binoculars and watch them from as far away as you can to give them their space. A lot of people get excited about visiting nesting sites over and over again because they want to see the progress that the babies are making. But we have to remember each time that we come out to that site, that adds a little bit more stress and de-stress to that bird. So keeping your distance, being able to watch from a distance is really, really important. I think of folks, too, that enjoy walking with their pets or their animals. You know, dogs, especially a lot of us who have dogs, and I'm a dog owner. I walk my dog on a leash because he's a tiny dog, but I used to have larger dogs, and I used to love to go for a hike with my dogs in the woods. And there are times, again, during the breeding season for birds when it's really good to have your dog on a leash so that disruption is much lower. If you're a photographer, learning how to pick up on the stress signals of birds. I teach folks about loons and what they look like when they're stressed, those pictures that you see where the loon rises up and you can see the breast, but the loon's wings are going,
yeah.
That's actually a stressed signal. So we want to pay attention to the cues that birds are giving us. Their calls will change. They'll become sharper. They're more stressed sounding. And so those can be keys to you that you are a little bit too close.
Well, birds in general are facing challenges. I mentioned there are 200 to 400 billion in the world. But the numbers are dropping. So what are some of the causes that we're seeing?
Yeah. So Partners in Flight, which is a large international research organization, just came out with a report in September of this year about North American birds. And they're saying that we have 1 billion fewer birds than we did 40 years ago. So we're at about 10 billion birds here in North America. And 86 of North America's 450 breeding bird species are actually vulnerable right now. So we're seeing declines in a lot of different birds, and we're also seeing more rapid declines. Partners in Flight has put together some numbers where they're looking at what the half-life in years of birds are, meaning that the number that they're at now, how rapidly is that number going to be cut in half?
Oh,
so if we look at that black pole warbler that I was telling you about, so in the past 40 years, so since 1970, we've seen about 80 to 90% decrease in the population of that bird in North America. So the half-life of that bird as it stands right now is about 16 years, where we're going to see that population drop in half again. So the biggest things that are a threat to birds right now, and I think if you look across the research that's being done by Audubon, by Partners in Flight, by the American Bird Conservancy, is habitat loss and the degradation of habitat. And one of the things that I think about a lot is how can we look both on the personal level and then also on the community or landscape level? So personally, in my backyard or in the land that I might own, if I'm a landowner that has, you know, a couple, maybe 25 to 100 plus acres, what can I do that is going to protect the types of habitats that I have there? Think about how do I fit into the natural landscape of Vermont and what can I do to protect habitat there? And then if I kind of blow that out a little bit more on the community level, I also like to encourage people to think about what's our kind of natural community niche where we live in Vermont. So the Northeast Kingdom is like boreal forests. We've got towns along the Connecticut River or Lake Champlain. And then we've got folks along, you know, the mountains, the Green Mountain Range. And if we think about the habitats in each of those different types of places, how can we steward them to the best of our ability? And some of the things that we can look at are improving management practices, whether they're agricultural management practices that will help give grassland birds a little bit more of an edge during the breeding season, or forest management practices that will make forests more healthy for our breeding birds, or right down to the backyard level. I mean, I own an acre and a half in St. Albans City, but I spent this summer looking at ripping out as much of the invasive species plants as I could. And I took honeysuckle out and I put things like dogwood in. So the common things that I see pop up in all of these reports are landscape scale management. So instead of, we can look at our personal landscape, but then let's look at the larger landscape and how we fit into it. And then the citizen science piece comes back over and over and over again. Even if we look at the Vermont State Wildlife Action Plan, which right now has 50 species of birds on it listed as species of greatest conservation need, they even say that monitoring is key to understanding how we can come up with strategies to help these birds, whether going back again to those land management practices or some policies that might need to be put in place.
If you could give Vermont a grade, how are we doing?
You know, I'm really proud of the work that goes on here. I am amazed at the partnerships that happen between Vermont Forest Parks and Recreation, Fish and Wildlife. I think of the Vermont Center for Eco Studies. We have the great folks at Outreach for Earth Stewardship who are doing the on-the-ground work when birds get injured, to Audubon Vermont's work with the Forest Bird Initiative, and now the maple-friendly sugarbush management practices. Yeah. So that's another big piece that's really core here in Vermont. We have a lot of land that are working landscapes. And so how do we keep being able to pull product off the landscape and at the same time keep the landscape healthy for birds and other wildlife? And I think we're doing a really good job of that here in this state.
KT in Saxton's River loves when you're on the show, said, I had a family of red-bellied woodpeckers resting near my yard all summer. I still see them at my suet. Will they stay all winter? And I heard you talking about red-breasted nuthatches. I have quite a few of those here, too.
Wow. You got an awesome backyard. So red-bellied woodpeckers are one of those more southern species. So what's cool about Vermont is we're kind of the southern range. Let me slow down. Southern range for northern species of birds and the northern range for southern species of birds. So you get this kind of cool
nice overlap,
right? And so even and as climate change starts to kind of affect us, we're going to see southern species pushing up north more so, and we're going to see some of those northern species that we normally see leave stick around longer. So we're going to have these weird little changes. I would be curious to see if that red-bellied woodpecker family does stick around, or are they one of these like little short-distance migrants that might kick out someplace else. I have a feeling they're pretty hardy, like most of our other resident woodpeckers, and they are going to stick around. Wow. Put some suet out, see if they'll come, try different types of suet. Peanuts, I'm curious about experimenting with a peanut bird feeder where you get shelled peanuts and put them in the feeder to see if that'll attract different woodpeckers to our yard this
year.
Nice.
I'm heading to Saxton's River.
Yeah, right?
You have not heard a single syllable of politics today on Vermont Edition, nor will you. We're taking a break from all that and focusing on the fall bird migration with bird diva Bridget Butler. You can join us by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or by sending an email to vermontedition@vpr.net. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. And joining me is someone who knows just about all there is to know about birds and the fall bird migration. It's bird diva Bridget Butler. She's nodding her head vigorously. Yes,
no.
I do. You can join us by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or by posting your questions or comments on our Vermont Edition Facebook page. We did hear from Debbie in Bethel, and she asks, are hawk migrations over yet? And even if they're done this year, for future reference, where are the best places to see hawks migrating besides Mount Philo and Hawks Mountain?
Oh, okay. So you hit the two. Mount Philo is a really good one. I think Putney, down in Putney, there's another one. So hawk migration tends to be on those warmer fall days. So we're starting to get into the cooler fall days. So hawks are one of the birds that migrate during the day. So we call them diurnal migrants. That's so fancy. Other birds tend to migrate at night when the air is cooler and to avoid the hawks as predators. If you're a small songbird, you don't want to be migrating the same time that the big hawks are. So the hawks take advantage of thermals that kind of build up through the day as the air warms up and then rises up against the mountains or the hillsides here in Vermont. And what they're doing is they do something called kettling, where they ride the thermal up, they kind of spiral up to the top. And as the air cools, they can key into that and feel that. When the air cools, they drop off of the top, and it's wonderful to go and watch because then they shoot off the top and they soar south, right, until they pick up that next thermal, and then they're going to rise that up. And so often it's this spiraling mass of hawks overhead. And Mount Philo, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure it's down in Putney, there's another hawk watch station down there where you can hang out. You can find birders there. Philo posts how many hawks that they see. It's in the thousands on some days when it's really nice and warm. And there are folks there that can help you learn how to identify the raptors by silhouette. You're looking up. The bird is backlit most times, but we can break down birds by their different shapes, silhouettes, and in the sky and how they soar. So you can see osprey, you can see eagles, turkey vultures, Cooper's hawk, sharp-shinned hawk, broadwings, all kinds of birds at these mountain sites. You know, and I love trying to figure out where, because I don't live close to Philo, and I definitely don't live close to Putney. I'm up in the St. Albans area. So there are a couple spots where I like to watch for, and there is a wonderful ridge line running, it's like French Hill, from north to south, right outside of St. Albans City. And I just watch that. And most of the time, the turkey vultures are the ones that are big enough to really cue you in. And you'll be able to see them kind of catching those thermals. I would say any place near you where there's a nice ridge line that's going to catch those warm thermals is a good spot to go. And we are moving out of that time and kind of into the time when people get really excited about geese and waterfowl.
Yeah. All right. Let's get some calls in. We've got Roberta calling from Montpelier. Roberta, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hi. Oh, thanks for taking my call. And it sounds like we're segueing right into geese, because that's my question. Why do the snow geese seem to only appear in the Lake Champlain area? I mean, we have a lot of bodies of water in Vermont, but that's where I hear that you go to see them. And if you could talk a little bit about how one would do that.
Most definitely. So, we are part of the Atlantic Flyway. There are a couple different flyways across the United States. We have the Pacific and then the Mississippi Flyway in the middle and then the Atlantic Flyway. And along those, they kind of follow the outline of the country. But then within each of those flyways, there are smaller ones. And if you took an aerial view, if you go online and maybe jump into Google Earth and you kind of zoom out, Lake Champlain is a wonderful north to south kind of highway. So is the Connecticut River. And on either side of Lake Champlain are these wonderful agricultural fields. And that's where the geese like to stage. And that's the spot where they're going to stop and rest and eat and communicate with each other. And so that's why that Champlain Valley is that key spot for them. That doesn't mean that you won't see smaller little drips and drabs of snow geese that might have peeled off and have found their own secret stash of corn somewhere that they're going to feed on for the day. But they do tend to be along either side of Lake Champlain. Now, the other thing
that's kind of shifted a little.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Rick. That's exactly
yes,
it.
Have.
So back in the day, and I can say this, back in the day, down at Dead Creek, we used to see them in the 10 tens of thousands. Well, the farming practices have shifted a little bit, and actually the bumper crop of corn is now on the New York side of the lake, which is great for me being up in St. Albans because I just hop across to the other side of the lake. So Chazy, New York is a really great spot. Now, if you want to keep up with this, you want to hook up with another birder in Vermont. His name's Brian Pfeiffer. You can find him online. And he is doing a snow goose report this year.
Oh,
so
nice.
He is keeping it updated. He has his own snow goose page, and it links you to the eBird maps for snow geese. Now, I have checked in on that this morning. So the up-to-date report is down at Dead Creek, we're seeing anywhere between 300 and 1,300 right now down in the Dead Creek area, which is nothing, Rick.
No, I know, I know.
You got to come over to Chazy. So on the New York side of the lake, and it's in the, let's see, Monte Bay, and I want to say Kings Bay. So head over to Chazy, New York, and just drive those roadways right along Lake Champlain. And we're talking tens of thousands last year. And on my Bird Diva Facebook page, I've got a great video of this. We pulled over to a farm field that had over 40,000 geese in it. It was amazing. And then on the Bay side, there was a report last year of upwards of 100,000 geese over there in the marina along the Chazy side of the lake. So,
all right, let's go north of the border. We've got Luana calling us from Montreal. Hi, Luana.
Comment. I'm responding to your wondering about the success of peanut feeders with woodpeckers. I spend my summers an hour and a half north of Montreal in a pretty isolated area, and I've had woodpeckers coming every year to the peanut feeder, and for the last 3 years I've had a male woodpecker feeding peanuts to its offspring, which is almost the same size as the parent, which spends most of its time squawking on a branch, you know, demanding peanuts. And finally, after a couple of weeks, ends up on the feeder. And I thought it was bizarre that it was a male woodpecker feeding the young. And then I noticed the same thing in Montreal on my peanut feeder right in the heart of the city.
Nice. You
so
asked
hang
about
up
peanuts.
Your peanut
awesome.
Feeders.
All right, so and that's great. Thank you for that report, Luana. Now, we just got a picture in from Carol in South Stratford, wants help identifying this bird.
I'm being handed the picture right now, and I'm orienting it properly. Okay, so this is from Carol in South Stratford, down in Heartland. So she says, is this a vireo? And it's a bird with a jet black eye and a jet black beak, a little bit of black over the nose, and then gray down the back. This is a tufted titmouse.
Ah.
So, yes, very close to a vireo. I can see why you would have thought that. But a couple of things right away kind of cue me in. Not a lot of vireos like to go to feeders. The other thing that you can look at, and if you go to your bird book and you look at tufted titmouse and then you look at the vireo family, you're going to notice the tufted titmouse has a bit of a tuft to the head, a lot like a cardinal. Now, they can lay that set of feathers back, so in your picture, it doesn't look like it has much of a tuft. And then the beak. Beaks are really key to tell you what the bird likes to eat, and they can really help you with identification. So the tufted titmouse has a very nice triangular beak, and if you notice on the vireos, they have a longer, somewhat thinner beak to them. Great question, though.
Well, that's fantastic. All right, Julie's calling us from Morrisville. Julie, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. You there, Julie?
Well, not.
All right, that was some kind of a bird call. Let's try Lynette in Greensboro Bend.
Saw it owl.
Hi, Lynette.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Boy, the lady from Montreal beat me to one of my punches, and I make peanut feeders, and I use whole peanuts, and the birds will hang on, and actually, after I eat lunch, I've got to go out there and dump the whole thing and see which ones have anything left in them and refill. But I have downy hairies, woodpeckers, both kinds of nuthatches that are here all the time, and as I call them, the pink birds. The purple finches are here most all the, I mean, all the birds you've talked about are just my regular birds. But peanut feeder is wonderful, and yeah, the fathers and the mothers both feed the babies. That's my favorite thing all year, is to have the babies come to learn how to feed out of the out of the feeder. I just also wanted to mention I kayaked a week ago and saw six snow geese up at Flag Pond in Stannard, and they were very happy to share space with me, and I was thrilled.
Nice.
Excellent. Thanks, Lynette. We also heard from Andy. He writes, I had a family of American kestrels in my backfield in Westford this summer. I've never seen this bird before. Will they be wintering over?
No. Those guys are going to leave. They're in the falcon family. But here's something to encourage you to do. You can build a kestrel box. So kestrels like to nest in cavities. And this is one of the things as landowners or as backyard enthusiasts that we can do. We can protect snags for birds. And then if there are the absence of them, we can build a bird box for them. So there are specific designs for kestrel boxes online that you can put up to encourage those birds to stay. Around.
Anything really exciting you've seen so far during the fall that you want to tell us about before we say goodbye?
No, because I get excited about everything. I think the purple finch was like a really big deal in our backyard for our family. I have three little kids now, and they just eat up whatever comes at the feeder. So I'm enjoying slow birding now, Rick,
Nice.
And kind of looking at birding through my children's eyes. What am I looking forward to? I'm really looking forward to going on some waterfowl adventures. I hear there are surf scoters right now, which are an exquisite-looking diving duck on Lake Carmi and Lake Iroquois. So I'm hoping to get out and discover some ducks this fall.
Bridget Butler is the bird diva. Thank you so much for being with us.
You bet, Rick.
And that ends our politics-free hour. Tomorrow, back to the election coverage. The candidates for attorney general will be here for a face-to-face debate on Vermont Edition, Republican Deb Bucknum and Democrat T.J. Donovan. And then later this week, we'll host debates for the treasurer's race and for state auditor. Not too late to submit a question. You can email vermontedition@vpr.net. Vermont Edition is produced by Sam Gale Rosen and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Rick Singeri. Thanks for listening.